or the marshal, I should say. Have the marshal call the case, please.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Jessen, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. This is case number A21-1113, Ryan Leroy Smith, appellant versus State of Minnesota.
Good morning, Mr. Pfluger. Thank you for your willingness to participate remotely. As before, with the other arguments today, I'll make a couple of introductory remarks. First off, we will try and keep any interruptions on our end to a minimum, but we understand they can and do happen from time to time. We hope that you'll do the same. We also will try to accommodate if there's a technical problem. We'll make sure that you have all the time to which you're entitled. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Will Flegel, and along with Michael Van Berkum, we represent the appellant, Ryan Smith. We contend that he is eligible for compensation based on exoneration under 590.11, in part based on the Supreme Court's determination in his case that, quote, the evidence was insufficient to convict him, close quote, their reversal of that matter for which he served 43 months in prison. Despite the state's agreement that Ryan was exonerated, that was their position in the stipulation or joint petition, Judge Mark Herzig denied the petition for compensation, determining that, quote, Mr. Smith does not meet the definition of exonerated. And it's, I think, the basis for Judge Herzig's determination is revealed at page 4, paragraph 4, where he says that the reversal by the Supreme Court was, quote, based solely on statutory interpretation and whether it was proper to use Mr. Smith's 2005 criminal vehicular operation conviction to enhance his conviction for driving while impaired to a felony level.
Mr. Flegel, if I may jump in, because I think a starting point for our analysis is that Supreme Court decision. And so to understand the reason why the conviction was vacated, I have a couple of questions about that opinion. I understand that for federal Supreme Court opinions, when there's a fragmented opinion, it is under the Marks rule, the most narrow of the concurrences that would be the controlling opinion. So in this case, you have a three-justice plurality, a three-justice dissent, and a concurrence from Justice Gilday. So the first question I have we in Minnesota adopted the Marks rule to determine which is the controlling opinion? And if so, which do you think is the more narrow opinion? And then make the argument as to under that opinion, whether or not we are, what was the reason to vacate the conviction?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'd like to write you a law review article on that.
I'll take it.
Okay. I'll give you my opinion, but that's all it is. I think the approach that is probably the most conservative would simply be to view that the plurality decision effectuates an outcome, but we have to narrowly read the various positions that are articulated in the concurrences. We know what happened, and it's a little more informative than a decision that's affirmed based on an equal division of the court. But I think the outcome here that we know for certainty is that there was a reversal and that the logical justification for that ultimate outcome is that the CVO charge, and I'll just use my own vernacular here, was not on the list of charges that could be considered.
I don't think that's where Justice Gilday came out. It seems to me her decision was saying that the statute's ambiguous and then under the rule of lenity in this particular case. And that to me seems a much more narrow decision. You're applying the rule of lenity in this specific case to determine that it's not on the list for him. That seems more narrow than the plurality opinion, which says it's unambiguous, not on the list under our, you know, pure textualist reading of the statute. So if that is the case, then as I'm looking at King Bird and trying to distinguish it, what is the distinguishing factor? If it is, in fact, based on whether or not the conviction is vacated because of application of existing law versus some new change, then I'm having I have a bit of a concern here, because it seems to me that you could argue, at least, even though the state isn't here, there could be an argument that Justice Gilday's opinion is not based on existing law, but is in fact a new determination, finding it is ambiguous, and then moving to the rule of lenity to resolve in that particular case.
Well, you know, I've made a three strikes and you're out argument here. And I think three justices beat one justice in that respect. However,
that's not the Marx rule. You know, that would mean we're adopting a different rule than the federal Supreme Court to determine which is the controlling opinion.
But can I cut to the chase here, so to speak? There are a number of predicates for Ryan to win, but fundamentally they were observed by Judge Herzig to be either a determination that there was a reversal and a reversal occurred. The other alternative is that there be vacation. And the Judge Kulik did vacate the opinion. So that first predicate, vacation or reversal, occurred regardless of whose opinion we're dealing with. And that leaves a secondary inquiry. And we can debate whether it's one of fact or law or mixed of fact and law. But the second inquiry is whether there is evidence of factual innocence. And that takes us into King Bird. And I don't know if you've had the opportunity to listen to the oral argument that was 2 weeks ago before the Supreme Court there. But it seemed to me as though that a dichotomy was forming. We had a lot of discussion about what BB guns are, but fundamentally the dichotomy is, and this seems to be what was used to justify the outcome in King Bird, the dichotomy is we're going to give exoneration if there is factual innocence of the conduct of the charges, but we are reticent to do it if there is legal innocence of the crime based on a technicality. And for the underlying philosophy as to why that dichotomy should exist, you have the Buell decision that Judge Rodenberg was on the panel of that one. That's the Spriegel decision, but they used a hypothetical to illustrate the conundrum. And the hypothetical was a drug case where, for constitutional reasons, the drugs are suppressed, even though we know the accused was literally holding the bag. Would we want to allow compensation for exoneration where there was an indication of factual innocence, actually factual guilt, based on what I'll call just a legal technicality? If that's the takeaway and that's the dichotomy, factual innocence of the conduct underlying the charges gets exoneration, legal innocence of the crime, we have a problem with that for the reasons expressed in King Bird and Buell. Then in Ryan's case, he has at least a finding of that he did not commit one of the qualifying acts that would justify the first degree DWI charge. Both factually and legally, he could not be charged with the crime for which he served 43 months. So I think we are distinct from King Bird. We're closest to the unpublished decision of Livingston. Livingston was the opinion that Judge Ross wrote about the hazardous substance. This loops back to my observation about, is it on the list? Because in Livingston, while it was illegal to operate a vehicle under the influence of a hazard substance, the chemical difluoroethane was not on the list, and therefore it could not count towards violation. And Livingston says, just as BAC 3 decided by this court only in June of this year, BAC 3 says, a quote, the crime was not committed, close quote, then the person is exonerated.
So legally. If I may.
Please.
Okay. So if we agree with you that your client was factually innocent of the conduct, and so he was exonerated, my question is, what happens next? Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot more than just technical exoneration to get through 590.11 to end up with the order that's set forth in, I think, subdivision 7. And I ask this because I was particularly trying to figure out how we look at this in light of the joint petition for the order. And that joint petition isn't just saying he was exonerated, but a joint petition for order declaring eligibility for compensation. So I'm trying to figure out what has the state agreed to. And if we were to remand, because we're looking at exoneration de novo, what do those remand instructions look like?
Boy, you saved all the hard questions for me.
There wasn't anyone else to ask them of.
Well, yes, I guess that makes me the expert then. I know you're completely conversant with the brief, and we went through the four criteria there, but I'm just going to give you again my opinion. Under subdivision 7, it's, in my judgment, a mixed question of fact and law for the trial judge. And so I think you have to give direction. My conclusion that I wrote for you is that you should reverse and remand with instructions, and specifically for a finding of exoneration, because I think you can do that based on the four criteria we went through. But I don't wanna over ask here. And we are really kind of plowing new ground. Obviously, the legislature didn't do anyone a favor by the attempt to clarify the statute. Again, that's just my opinion. I mean, if we've got well-meaning jurists at the trial court and the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court struggling with this statute, respectfully, you know, there's something to be said for Justice Gilday's observation that there's an ambiguity here.
If I can just specifically ask you for an example about the hearing. Subdivision 6 says the court shall set a hearing on the petition, but here we have a joint petition. I mean, do we just say, you know, assuming we agree with your position on exoneration, do we just leave that to the district court? Just any guidance you can give us?
Pardon me. The more guidance I think we can give, the more helpful it will be. I do think Judge Herzig tried his best here in a very confusing sea, but the ultimate determination, I think, has to be whether there was factual and legal exoneration. I think the stipulation, to my mind, and I'm going to draw on a civil analogy here, if you have the defense of a case and your expert says yes, and I have an expert and my expert says yes as well, the jury or fact finder is within their power to reject the facts and reach a decision of their own. That's where the jury hears testimony and resolves issues of credibility. This case was presented on a stipulation where we can't derive credibility, so the record is far narrower. And I think on this record, factually, he's exonerated because there's no evidence to the contrary. The only way to change that would be a legal argument along the lines of Kingbird that we were wrestling with earlier. So I've avoided answering your question. I'm sorry. It's the best thing I think you could do is to reverse and remand with instructions to find exoneration. That would certainly achieve what I think is the proper result. Does the court have any other questions?
All right.
I could entertain you a while longer, but I'll let you just reflect on what I've given you so far. Thank you kindly for letting us appear in this manner.
We will take the briefs under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.